welcome back to the Socialist Shelf. We're talking Slaughterhouse-Five by Kurt Vonnegut, part two, right now. So hold on to your hats, because we're jumping through time.
And I want to pick up on, you know, mentioning him being unstuck in time. Another thing that's interesting that he leaves to the reader is it never tells you why Billy's unstuck in time, you know? Mm-hmm. In fact, the Tralfamadorians are like, yeah, no, we have nothing to do with it. We can explain it. We don't got anything to do with it. And, you know, there's really the easy reading is, well, he got in a plane crash and he's got, you know, he suffered damage and he has trauma and he has a weird way of viewing the world. And you know, and that can be simultaneously true with other things. But it is interesting, and it also allows, you know, Vonnegut to air out some of his own personal philosophies and feelings. It's another thing that, you know, is left up to question. And, another thing that, you know, like the Tralfamadorians, that feels so out of place in the novel. It feels like if you told me I was going to read a book about the firebombing of Dresden, I just would not imagine little green men would appear. I would not imagine time travel would appear. It's simply not a thing I would think would be in the novel. I don't think there's an easy answer for it. You know, I don't think there's an easy, you know, some interpretations of this book likes to say the easy answer, well, Billy goes insane. And be that as it may, whether Billy is insane or not, it's still not something that you can just kind of hand wave, you know. Mm-hmm. Even if you want to point out, well, Montana Wildhack is wearing a necklace that has the same words that were up in Billy's office, that means that he's dreaming. Okay, but also, like, who cares? That's not the point, you know.
Right, exactly. You know, it's you know, his family around him, you know, his daughter who thinks he's senile by that point, right? You know, it's the question is not, okay, is this person insane or not? The question, the question is, you know, whose perspective are we seeing this from?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
You know, and you can only really understand that perspective if you get in that person's head.
Yeah, absolutely.
And he, like Jacob mentioned, he definitely gives a lot of, you know, stuff to go either way. It felt almost like Total Recall, where you can just kind of read the events either way.
Sure.
I mean, like him being in the bookstore, the same, you know, and you know, having the Kilgore Trout stories be like somewhat identical to what he's experiencing, and, you know, seeing the actress right before he's like starts describing these visions and everything, and it can go both ways. I definitely found myself, though, this time, I think the first time I thought, okay, he's just crazy. But this time I was like, you know what? I don't know why, but I gave complete credence to it. I was like, yeah, this is happening. This is real. He got kidnapped.
I mean, Tralfamadorians pop up in other novels.
Yeah.
It's canon. It's a collective delusion. If it's a delusion, you know,
they're canon. And I definitely like his like, you know, again, like, you know, he gives this description of his death in the future, which is told like it's something that's already happened, because, again, the way that time is, you know, told in the story is very interesting.
Fixed.
But he has this messianic moment where he's just like, his security guards are all around him, and he's like, no, like, this must go. And then, you know, like we talked about earlier, Lazaro's hitman that he's hired?
I think it's Lazaro himself.
That's so much funnier to imagine, yeah. Like, decrepit little Lazaro with the las gun.
Another great, not to talk too much about the movie, but another great scene in the movie. Oh my God.
Gosh, that's in the movie?
They age him up, and it's so funny. Like, okay, it's like prosthetic, that. Like, oh, it's so funny.
Is there any sign that America's been balkanized in the film?
There's like a flag that you don't know what it's the flag of. In the background. Okay. So like if you'd read the book, you'd be like, oh, it's the flag of like whatever state. And it is like, it's a weird looking, like the, like there's like, it, there's, it's clearly like a different future culture. So like, yeah, there's like signs to it, but it doesn't really harp on it.
Oh yeah. And nor does the book.
Yeah.
Something talking about Paul Lazaro, something I really wanted to talk about that stuck with me the first time, and it definitely again the second time, is the portrayal of the British officers in this
book
is fantastic.
Also, for context for the readers, before Trent, before you say that,
yeah, go ahead.
Just to like give context, if you haven't read the book, When they get taken to a German prisoner of war camp, there's a section of the prisoner of war camp that's like treated better than like the Russian section, which it's British officers. And they are taken in by these British officers. And Trent, you can talk about what you're going to say about them. I just wanted to, you know, clarity for the listeners, because yeah, it's easy to get carried away.
Yeah, totally. Well, it's just, you know, they get to this camp, and then the camp is specifically designed for Russian soldiers. And I think this is where you can tell Vonnegut is one of the people who actually understands that the way that the war was fought by the Nazis on the Eastern Front is vastly, vastly, vastly different. I mean, the brutality of the Western Front is definitely portrayed in the book, but like, you can't even begin to imagine. And the Russians who are interned at this camp are treated like subhuman dogs. Mm-hmm. And it's and they're being killed. Anytime that Billy Pilgrim like interacts with them, they're like listless. They're just like, you know what I mean? They're not impolite or
yeah, they're nothing.
Mean or brutish. Yeah. They're just like their souls are just sucked out of them. They're just these already dead people just existing. And then you see you interact with these people, and then you have these British soldiers who have like infinite rations. They're all
clerical error.
Exactly. They're all bulked up. They're having a wonderful, jaunty, homoerotic, lovely time where they're doing a play to welcome of the Cinderella. Americans. Yes. Which also another thing that with Vonnegut being obsessed with certain things, he loves Cinderella. I don't know why, but Vonnegut loves Cinderella. But anyway, they're described as very handsome. He loves saying in this book that people are molded like cannonballs, you know, like the muscles. And yep. So it's very homoerotic and they get along with the Germans and it's fine.
Yeah, they call them Jerry.
Yeah,
and don't let Jerry get you down.
Yeah, like basically Billy Pilgrim's, you know, the main character, he's wearing this coat from a very clearly killed person. There's bullet holes going through it, and the British officer's reaction to him just looking miserable in this coat, like, you know, freezing to death, was, oh, they pulled a prank on you. You can't let them do that. You've got to show your masculinity, you know. You gotta stand up for yourself. And it's
notable that they were captured in one of the first battles of the war too.
Yes,
like these guys didn't fight at all, essentially. Mm. And like, they just were like, yeah, they've just been waiting it out.
And the Americans are just so like, you know, they're so like, not really disrespectful, but like their etiquette does not meet the standards of the British, and they're very turned off by the Americans, who like, after not eating for like 10 days, have just huge stomach fits after they eat this big feast. And the British are so turned off by it that like a German officer literally comes and is like, I am so sorry, guys. Like, they'll be gone really soon. Like, I promise. And then we can all continue to play cards and do plays and musicals. And the British are like, okay, we understand. Like, you know, they're like literal prisoners of war. There's like Russians like one fence away who are just like on death's door and are being killed daily. Crazy contrast.
And I mean, like, and yeah, like while they're there, Paul Lazaro gets in a fight with one of them, right? He gets his arm broken, I think, because he tries
to steal something. And the guy, and it's described that the British guy like basically didn't even understand what was going on and just like accidentally broke his fucking arm completely.
An anime character just like didn't even like built massive, like he's out of JoJo's Bizarre Adventure or something. And you got these like these little wretched guys walking around. Oh man. Yeah, I there's an interesting part. There's an interesting part in 1 second. Let me see if I can find this exactly. Yeah. There's a really interesting section in the book where Vonnegut's politics stick out in this exact same area as well. And a German major reads out loud a passage from a monograph by Howard W. Campbell Jr. We said we'd mention him again. He's a well-known playwright and propagandist for Nazi Germany. And he's the main character of Vonnegut's earlier novel, Mother Night. And Vonnegut heads will know Howard Campbell Jr. is a spy. He is spying on the Nazis. He is not a real Nazi. In fact, he's but you know, he does have to live the rest of his life afterwards knowing he fought for the Nazis during the war. Yes, he helped lead to their defeat, but he actually had to experience that. You know, it's a good book. It's interesting.
You are who you pretend to be. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. But Howard Campbell Jr. has written this criticism of the United States that in the book is interesting because it's coming from, like, it's being read out loud by a fascist, you know, so it rings strange, if nothing else. But I kind of wanted to read part of it because it is, like, so cutting, and it is still so applicable, and because I feel better agreeing with it, knowing Howard Campbell Jr. is not actually a Nazi, having written it. Obviously, Vonnegut wrote it, but you know what I mean. But I like this quote, and it's him talking about why American prisoners of war don't behave well, quote unquote. And it goes like this, quote, "America is the wealthiest nation on earth, but its people are mainly poor, and poor Americans are urged to hate themselves. To quote the American humorist Ken Hubbard, it ain't no disgrace to be poor, but might as well be. It is, in fact, a crime for an American to be poor, even though America is a nation of poor. Every other nation has folk traditions of men who were poor but extremely wise and virtuous, and therefore more estimable than anyone with power and gold. No such tales are told by the American poor. They mock themselves and glorify their betters. The meanest eating or drinking establishment owned by a man who was himself poor is very likely to have a sign on its wall asking the cruel question, 'If you're so smart, why ain't you rich?' There will also be an American flag no larger than a child's hand glued to a lollipop stick and flying from the cash register. Americans, like human beings everywhere, believe many things that are obviously untrue. Their most destructive untruth is that it is very easy for any American to make money. They will not acknowledge how, in fact, hard money is to come by, and therefore, those who have no money blame and blame and blame themselves. This inward blame has been a treasure for rich and powerful who have to do less for their poor publicly and privately than any ruling class since, say, Napoleonic times. Many novelties have come from America. The most startling of these, a thing without precedent, is a mass of undignified poor. They do not love one another because they do not love themselves. Once this is understood, the disagreeable behavior of American enlisted men in German prisons ceases to be a mystery." End quote. And I found that to be a pretty, despite coming from an undercover Nazi, a pretty cutting analysis of the United States to this very day.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I am glad that Joss, that you did get to read Mother Night, because that is the one thing I got back going through, is everything is so much funnier realizing that he's, like, basically a progenitor to the CIA's asset. Like, it's so much better.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and he shows up later in the book wearing a Nazi uniform with, like, an American flag superimposed over it,
and it's described like clownish as shit, like,
oh yeah,
like beyond anything you'd see in American Psycho, right? Just all these clashing colors and let me find it, actually.
Another thing that goes great and is great in the movie, and you have Edgar Derby have a moment where he gets offered by Howard Campbell Jr. wearing the suit, "Hey, you should join our Free America Corps," and Edgar Derby gets to have a heroic moment where he's just like, you know, speaks on the freedom of the United States and how they'll never stand with the fascists. And, again, he gets to have that moment.
Yeah, he is literally like I'm thinking about all of Vonnegut's other books. I don't think he's ever written anybody as heroic. You know what I mean? He usually doesn't have, like, heroes and villains. So to have a character who at every turn, like, he is the hero of this story. He is the person who does every noble thing. He's when Billy Pilgrim gets sick, he's the one who watches over him. Like, he's the you can tell Vonnegut really thinks a lot of whoever, like, whether that was his real name in real life or whoever it was that Vonnegut saw.
Looking for that quote, I even saw that Edgar Derby at one point is described as having the best body and physique of all the Americans.
Mm.
Like, literally,
he's
just
like, he's the best of them. And he's the one who doesn't go home. In fact, you know, there's the part about saying none of the real soldiers survived the war. He's the real soldier. He doesn't come home. Billy Pilgrim and Paul Lazzaro go home. You know, it's interesting. The real soldiers, the scouts, Edgar Derby, those guys are dead and buried in an unmarked grave somewhere. You know.
Yeah, I would definitely recommend for everyone at home to just look up Howard Campbell Slaughterhouse Five, because the American Nazi outfit that Jacob was describing is
I might put it, might make it the episode art.
You actually should, because I think it's very good.
I found the passage that that describes it.
Shall we get read it, read it.
Campbell was an ordinary looking man, but he was extravagantly costumed in a uniform of his own design. He wore a white 10-gallon hat and black cowboy boots decorated with swastikas and stars. He was sheathed in a blue body stocking, which had yellow stripes running from his armpits to his ankles. His shoulder patch was a silhouette of Abraham Lincoln's profile on a field of pale green. He had a broad armband, which was red, with a blue swastika in a circle of white.
Oh my God.
Yeah,
so
funny.
The movie doesn't quite capture.
No, it doesn't quite get it.
I think what would have been necessary is the 10-gallon hat is a crucial part of that.
I agree.
It's just so like I think Jacob, leading up to us talking about this, I think one of the things you said about the book was just like how Vonnegut is just so like effortlessly creative. And it's just, this is just a perfect example. Like he's just so funny. Like this is just perfect.
Somebody online, I can't lay claim to this joke, said that he was dressed like not Yosemite Sam, but Anti-Semite Sam. And that fits a little too well. I don't know where I read it. I want to credit it, but credit to a nameless person I read years ago after I first read this book. But man, it really is. It's just another one of those little details of there's just so much wacky shit in here. Like just off the wall stuff that just happens. Like it'll just, you know, you'll be going along and then you'll just have this. You'll just have, you know, a whole diatribe about a failed science fiction writer who convinces a lady at a party that hell is real and that it's illegal to write anything in a novel that didn't actually happen in real life. And it's not, like, it just stuff just kind of happens.
It's
all part of the just, like I said before, tapestry of this book. You're just kind of walking around and it's Vonnegut saying like, here's this room I've created of just stuff. It's here, there, everywhere. And you can kind of, I'll take out my items and show it to you. Like, to make the Franco connection, like the guy from Spring Breakers running around saying, look at my shit and grabbing this and that and just shoving it all in your face. And then what is your takeaway after it?
And again, you know, the incredible bathos of these parts, you know, like the incredible, like, you know, the wackiness it's bathos because it's counterposed with some of the most horrific shit imaginable. Like just the paragraph before you see the American Nazi outfit, right? As you say, Campbell's recruiting for the Free American Corps, for Americans to fight on the Nazi side. And where is they supposed to fight? They're supposed to fight only on the Russian front.
Yep, fight the Soviets.
The most brutal and horrific the most brutal and horrific front of the war, because that's where the genocidal war is going on against, you know, it's literally a war of extermination.
Yeah, and I don't have the exact quote in front of me here, but what Howard Campbell says, he's like, well, you guys are going to have to fight communism anyway, so you might as well fight it with me now.
Yeah, wow. I get it over with now. Yep,
exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
Which, interestingly enough, you know, who was it who said we fought the wrong? Was it Patton who said we fought the wrong enemy in this war? That was the American stance in some sectors, especially on the right. The one more thing I wanted to say about Howard Campbell Jr. One more reference to the movie is something it adds in that wouldn't have really worked in the book, but it works as a visual gag. Edgar Derby says, no one stand up, no one go with him. And Paul Lazara stands up and goes up to him. And they're like, Paul. And he said, and then Howard Campbell Jr. is like, let me shake your hand. He goes, I'm only here to tell you, don't answer your door, because one day someone's going to knock on it. And it cuts away from it. It works so well. It works so well. It just redoes
the bit. That's awesome.
Don't answer your door. And he's so short. Oh, my God. one day somebody's going to come knocking on it. But yeah, and I mean, like, even notably enough, like Mother Night shows that indeed the United States does very quickly go on to its war with the Soviet Union. And that's depicted in that novel. And, you know, readers of Mother Night who are reading this book would pick up on that, would be like, yeah, the U.S. did, in fact, immediately switch gears and go into wartime over the Soviet Union. And that's, you know, an underpinning of that novel.
There's a great book out there called The Nazis Next Door, which is about the American it's about the Americans spiriting various high-ranking Wehrmacht men over to the United States, and the resulting, like, you know, because they were here for several decades very plum positions, you know, and starting like the 70s or the 80s, there was this effort to hunt down these Nazis and root them out by individuals who realized, wait a minute, these people are evil. Why are they here? Right. So, yeah, you know, good book if you want to get a little bit of the real world story.
Absolutely. Okay, yeah, so to move along, because, you know, there's just a lot of this book, despite how, like, there's a lot to say, despite how relatively short it is. It's what, like 80,000 words? It's not particularly long.
There's just so many good ideas.
Yeah, there's just a lot. Yeah. It's, I mean, Vonnegut kind of mocks himself with the character of Kilgore Trout, I think. Unfairly mocks himself, but he does. Which, you know, for those who don't know, Kilgore Trout is a novelist I referenced to earlier, is a sci-fi novelist who can't write for anything, but he comes up with great ideas. And like Vonnegut, between this and his other novels where he has Kilgore Trout show up, very clearly makes fun of himself and his own ideas, and that he just likes to pump out ideas. But you do see that Vonnegut does have a lot of like threads in his head that eventually he can't follow every thread, so he just throws them in there. But you can see like this alternate career of Vonnegut as a Kilgore Trout character who like writes a book and then never thinks about it again. He like just throws it out the window and it's like next idea. Because there are so many threads.
There, but for the grace of God goes Vonnegut. Yeah, you know, I'm thinking of there's a thing that he says that like he didn't think of himself as a writer for the simple reason that the world had never allowed him to think of himself in this way. Yeah. You know, it's a question of, again, you know, finding your audience, right? And Billy Pilgrim happens to be the only man who gets it.
Him and Elliot Rosewater. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Also shows up in multiple Vonnegut novels. But so Billy, after the war, because in the war is, you know, there's not much more to say about, you know, what happens. Dresden, as we said, gets bombed. Edgar Derby dies. Billy goes home. He never really knows why he doesn't get executed by the Nazis in the aftermath between they get taken by the Soviets, taken, you know, into the custody of the Soviets. And Kurt Vonnegut says in his own memoir, I have no idea why the remaining Nazis who survived Dresden didn't kill us immediately. And he's like, I can't think of any good reason they didn't, but they just didn't. You know, obviously thankful they didn't, but just, you know, it's just a thing, another chance that they made it through. But yeah, Billy goes back. He goes to optometry school. He has sort of a breakdown for a little bit where he goes to a mental hospital. It's not a super important plot point, but he spends some time there, which is where he learns about Kilgore Trout, the novelist. But yeah, and he marries this he marries this woman that he doesn't really have a lot. I'm sorry, what's his wife's name? I feel bad.
What's her name? It's Barbara's the daughter.
Yeah, it's the daughter of the owner of the optometry school.
Valencia. Mm-hmm,
mm-hmm. Yeah, Valencia, who is this? She's like, Billy doesn't seem like he has a lot of feelings for Valencia. He marries her, like he doesn't dislike her. He's fond of her, but she's just this kind of this woman who is the daughter of the optometry school. She comes with a lot of money. You know, she's not seen as particularly attractive. So she's like very happy that she got a man like Billy, even though Billy doesn't see himself as much of a man. They're both just kind of some insecure people who, like, you know, by nature of, you know, and the grace of the GI Bill and the mid-century economy, shoot up to massive prominence and wealth and success. And on, you know,
I was going to say, before we recorded this podcast, we were talking about Dune. We're recording this the day that the Dune 2 trailer comes out. And actually, you know, there is a kind of a lot of parallels between Paul Atreides and Billy Pilgrim is the fact that they're both completely prescient, right? And so I thought it was very funny thinking about Dune. You know, Paul sees this woman and he sees his entire future with her and he's like, oh, I'm gonna love you for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. And in this book, Billy Pilgrim sees her and is like, I know things are gonna be very fine with us. Like things are gonna be okay for the most part.
The most mid-marriage of all time.
Yeah, like I just love the difference between Paul being like, oh, I'm always gonna love you, and him being like, things will be very stable and okay. I think we can do this.
Billy's like,
we will not start a galactic jihad.
Yeah. Billy's like, I'm going to cheat on you once and only once, and it'll be okay. Technically, yeah. I guess twice, but
I mean, I like
Montana Wild Hack is a little different.
Yeah, and I like, honestly, I think going back this time, I found them to be a little more romantic than before. I kind of enjoyed their wedding night.
The scene I do like that more. Part.
Yeah, I actually, despite it being described as, yeah, like a very mundane, not, it's not a very like whirlwind romance. Like it's a very like, you know, Billy doing something for
kind of
himself.
Transactional. Yeah.
Yeah. But it ends up being kind of, I mean, they're supportive to each other and they, you know, like, yes, Billy has his infidelity later, which is terrible, but you know, like he, and you know, based on that Geraldo Rivera quote I read earlier, you can imagine what Kurt Vonnegut thinks about infidelity. Yeah. Like that. Oh, but, but you know, I did kind of find this time that they were romantic, they were sympathetic. I mean Billy's completely like distant to everybody in this book for the most part.
Yeah, she's more bought in than he is.
Yeah, sure. But still you can tell he does care about her.
Yeah, like, when she thinks he's died, she dies because she drives in such a crazy way that she gets part of her car ripped off and she gets carbon monoxide poison.
Mm-hmm. Which her exhaust system, yeah.
And it's another irony where their kids get to the hospital and they think their dad has died. They get the news their dad's okay, but their mom is dead. You know, another just little moment of weird irony. Just to talk about the unfaithfulness for a second, it is weird because there is one reference to Billy at a party basically being unfaithful to his wife. Enough, I think it gets referenced like once in the entire book. And then you have obviously Montana Wild Hack, but that's a little bit of a different situation.
Yeah.
But we can talk about that though. The more specifically, because just to talk a little bit more about Trial Famador, on the night of his daughter's wedding, Billy is kidnapped by aliens, Trial Famadorians, who suck him up to space and take him 90 million light years away or some absurd number.
It's in the quadrillions.
It's huge, yeah. And they drop him in a dome. That's basically a recreation of his living room. And he's in a zoo and he's in there by himself for a while. And then Montana Wild Hack, who is a actress mostly known for like, you know, sexual films like porn and basically porn films, is put in there with him. And, you know, they have a romantic and sexual relationship that forms and they eventually have a child together. And when Billy gets returned, and it never really says why Billy is returned to Earth specifically, or it doesn't really give details on it. Montana Wild Hack stays behind to raise their child on Trial Famador. And the Trial Famadorians, you know, they have this, like we said, they see all of time at once. They see Earth. They feel very bad for humans seeing time linearly. And they describe it as, imagine a guy who's like locked in a case and he can only see one point. And he can't move and he's on a rail and it's taking him down and he sees a little more and he can never look back and never look forward and then thinks that's the whole world. And that's their view of time. So yeah, they have wars. Yeah, they have death. They just like to look at the good times because why not? And they see everything as completely immutable. They do not believe in free will. They say they've gone to dozens of planets and Earth is the only planet that has come up with the concept of free will. In fact, they know their planet is going to testing fuel in the universe. They know it's going to happen. And they're like, yeah, it always happens. It always will happen. We always let him push the button. And we always will let him push the button because we always have. Like they don't see time as anything but fixed, which, of course, Billy has to come to see as well due to his unique unstickiness, something like that. Is that a fair summary of the Trial Famadorians, you think?
Yeah, I would definitely say that one thing that I found kind of interesting when we were talking earlier about kind of like, is this real or is this Billy's imagination, is that like later in the book with Montana Wild Hack, like one of the last times we get a conversation with her is like they're already getting to that point in their relationship where they're kind of being like spatty with each other. Mm-hmm. Like he's like reading, like, you know, he's reading Kilgore Trout. She's like, oh yeah, but you really like that, huh? So like it is funny that if he is like imagining this, like he's imagining them getting to the point where they're like arguing with each other and like kind of like having those kind of like, you know, unhappy aspects of a relationship. But
if it's a delusion, it's not a halfway delusion. He's come up with lore.
I really like them as a I mean, they're explored more in other books like a little bit. And one thing that, like, to say about like all of other of Vonnegut's characters is with the maybe the caveat of Campbell, who I think is pretty pretty much concise. Like, he's the same in here as well as Mother Night. A lot of his characters do have, like, you know, inconsistencies. Like, they're a little bit different in each book. And like, for instance, in Sirens of Titan, the Trevalmadorian seems like way more high strung in that book, if I'm remembering correctly. Yeah. And like, not chill at all, and not these, like, where in this book they're like these, you know, like almost ascendant, you know, they're just, they're like basically God in some way, you know, like they know everything that's going to happen, and they're just like, this is it, we're just kind of viewing everything.
I like to imagine the difference is because in Sirens of Titan they're interacting with the Trelfamadorian on their terms, and in this they're interacting on the Trelfamadorian's terms. So it's kind of like they are presenting themselves to the human in Slaughterhouse-5. So like they're putting their best foot forward, as it were. They're like hey, this is our chance to come off as God, you know what I mean?
And
Whereas in Sirens of Titan, isn't he like a shipwrecked or something?
Yeah, they're trying to answer a question or something.
Uh-huh.
But the last thing I want to say about Trevalmadorians is that I really liked, like, Vonnegut, like, basically told a secondary version of them through a Kilgore Trout story, which he briefly goes into, which is like basically the same story, again giving credence to maybe the idea that Billy's just imagining this all. But in their version, I really like the idea that they were toying with the humans way more, and they were like making them invest in stocks. Like, even though they're on like a different planet, they're like investing in stocks on Earth, and they like invest in like bananas or something, and it goes badly. And so they can like, they're like, it's prayer week, and they like convince these like humans to believe in God, and then like the stock goes up.
It's all fake.
I'm a big fan of also the quick summary of the Kilgore Trout novel, where he talks about Jesus, where he says the actual Jesus story just teaches you don't kill someone if he's well connected. And he says in Kilgore Trout's version, Jesus really was a nobody and God adopted him. Which is, I think, also Kurt Vonnegut's own perspective of Jesus. Kurt Vonnegut was very, very, very invested in the person of Jesus, despite being pretty like if he was a teenager today, he would be like a Reddit atheist. But he really loved he left his wife over it, you know, like despite that, he loved the person of Jesus. He has a whole section in his memoir where he talks about he says, let's come to a he says he solved the problem on the debate of whether we should have the Ten Commandments up in schools and courts, because, you know, that was a big debate in 2005. And he said, instead, let's propose we put the Beatitudes up. Blessed are the meek, blessed are the peacemakers, blessed are the poor of spirit, for they will inherit the earth. And he says that's his, and he talks about how he would like to call out basically the religious right by saying, what if we put up Jesus's actual words instead of the Ten Commandments from the Old Testament? He felt very, you know, and it's of course a little trite to be like, you know, it's like a trite, like Jesus was a socialist kind of kitschy like statement, but like it is, there is a like truth to it, and Vonnegut clung to it very tightly, and he felt, you know, he took it very seriously.
Yeah. He would have done very well on r/ two sentence sci-fi stories.
Oh,
we had a lot of Reddit gold.
I love those so much.
Reddit gold. All my upvotes to Vonnegut. Yeah, he definitely had a situation where he said, he had a situation where he even had a friend who was like facing a judge for like his like activism and for fighting for socialism and this, that, and the other. And the judge says to him, and this is Vonnegut says this actually happened. The judge said to him, how does a man successful as you come to this? And he said, all because of those couple paragraphs that one man said on top of a mountain one time, referring to the Sermon of the Mount. So, you know, Vonnegut took it very seriously, and you can feel that interest in this novel as well.
Oh yeah, yeah. It's an interesting. I thought of Monty Python when you brought up Vonnegut's relationship with Jesus, right? Because when they were making Life of Brian, they were going to make it satire, like about Jesus, and they realized, well, there's not really a whole lot that we can find, like, you know, inherently funny about his teachings, you know?
Right.
So,
right.
Yeah. So it's you know, there's a spiritual element that you don't necessarily have to be religious to access.
For sure. And I also, and you know, and Vonnegut also makes it pretty clear in his memoir and his other interviews that he doesn't believe in things like heaven and hell. He finds them to be really ridiculous concepts, but he does have a sort of Tralfamadorian way of looking at things. He does really feel like time is, if you see time in his mindset as a dimension, the same as space, then we are just limited in our perception, and life is just, you know, death is illusory in the sense that we are always alive at some point, and indeed every point of our lives. It reminds me a whole lot of Alan Moore's book, Jerusalem. It's very similar to that, or to Alan Moore's other more famous book, Watchmen, of course, with Dr. Manhattan and all that. Very different. But I do think Vonnegut, I wonder if Vonnegut ever read Watchmen. I could see Vonnegut digging Watchmen. But
oh, definitely. Definitely. I mean, that's got to go on the list.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I wanted to quote something from Tralfamador because it was my favorite passage from this book. Maybe not as a standalone, but in reference to the novel itself. I found it to be the most useful. And Trent referenced it earlier. Quote, "There are no telegrams on Tralfamador, but you're right. Each clump of symbols is a brief, urgent message describing a situation, a scene. We Tralfamadorians read them all at once, not one after the other. There isn't any particular relationship between all the messages, except that the author has chosen them carefully so that when seen all at once, they produce an image of life that is beautiful and surprising and deep. There was no beginning, no middle, no end, no suspense, no moral, no causes, no effects. What we love in our books are the depth of many marvelous moments seen all at once," end quote. And I found that to be, you know, if you want to figure out what the point of this book is, I think you can't find any easier few sentences than that to say, well, point is a little bit of an aside, you know, but this is what we're doing. It's something that's beautiful and imperfect when taken all at once, and you can get what the author is getting at, whether or not he's able to make a concise point. Because like we said earlier, this is a very nuanced situation. You know, we're not talking about a war here that could be all out condemned the way that Vonnegut railed against Vietnam and railed against Iraq and Afghanistan. You're talking about World War II. You're talking about a complicated life. You're talking about a weird time in history. And you find in other of Vonnegut's works, specifically his nonfiction, he can be a lot less nuanced than he is here. He can be a lot more like, here's the deal, I'm laying down the law. Certainly when he talks about fossil fuels, in some of his 2005 essays, he is very much like, he doesn't show any level of nuance at all. And he got criticized for that by some. But in this book, he is able to show this broad tapestry because it is such a complicated situation, and it was so morally complicated for him, and there is no real takeaway. And at the end of the book, you're left like the bird, just kind of asking, you know, poots a wheat, you know, what the hell? We said it at the end of the last podcast, but we said we all some locusts for real, feeling very similar to that. It's just like, we all some locusts for real. We're all some birds for real. Just not really sure where to go, but this is this is what he had to share in a very Tralfamadorian sense, you know. If that makes any sense.
Yeah. I really enjoy this book. I think we referenced Mother Night the most. I would definitely recommend that one as well, just for more William or Howard Campbell stuff. I think that book has one of the funniest descriptions of like the far right, like,
oh my god,
this group of characters, so, and there is hilarious.
The dentist school,
yes, oh, literally. But I would say my favorite Vonnegut book, kind of similar to the way that this one works, where it goes all throughout a man's life, interspersed, not in a chronological order, is Bluebeard. Mm-hmm. I highly recommend it to anyone listening. If you want to get into Vonnegut, that's been my favorite. It's about painters. I would definitely recommend.
Absolutely. They're all good. I mean, Sirens of Titan, my god. I won't spoil it, but the night I finished it, I was just like, oh my god, staring at a wall.
Go ahead.
No, I was gonna say, yeah, I read, I've, I, Jacob knows, I finished Sirens of Titan right after a bad breakup, and I was ready to put my head through a wall. It was just one. I think of all of Vonnegut's books, that ending is just like a just needless gut punch as hard as physically possible.
Yeah. I also will say Cat's Cradle is another one. That's the one that really got him on the map. That one, if you want to know how Vonnegut feels about religion, I think that's Cat's Cradle is your best.
That's probably his most absurdist, or one of his most absurdist.
Oh my God. Yeah. I wrote an essay in college, or not an essay, a nonfiction story dedicated to Cat's Cradle. That pulls from it, and I love that book. It might be my favorite Vonnegut, that or Sirens of Titan, but they're all really good. You know, I'm not rushing to the end here, but like wrapping things up, coming to bigger conclusions here. What else should we take away from this? And you know, since the podcast is called The Socialist Shelf, I guess I would ask y'all's thoughts on is there anything we can learn politically from this book? And if so, what?
Well, you know, I mean, the obvious direction to go in first, of course, is way back in chapter one, you know, when he goes over to Dresden, when he goes over to East Germany at this time, and he meets his friend, right? And his friend, and he asks his friend, okay, well, how is it to live under this socialist government? And he's like, well, you know, at first it sucked because everybody had to work hard, but you know, and there wasn't much shelter and there wasn't much food, there wasn't much clothing, but things are better now. I got a place. My daughter's getting a great education, you know. So he doesn't, you know, he certainly doesn't shy away from the struggle and sacrifice that goes into creating such a socialist society, but you know, neither does he really return to it.
Well, yeah, of course there's the anti-war element as well. But it is, since it is so nuanced in the context, but yeah, there is that. And there is other books where he, you know, fleshes it out more, and certainly his essays, but yeah, it's not a thing that he dwells on, things like this, things like that, that initial part, or, you know, there is the politics of Billy Pilgrim is like, because of his class status, is kind of tied up in right-wing politics. Not really, just his circle is pretty right-wing. There's a bumper sticker that says Ronald Reagan for president, which is before Ronald Reagan was ever considered for president, so that was a predictor right there.
Oh yeah, and he's able to stumble into that like LitCrit podcast, not podcast, like radio show, accidentally.
Uh huh. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah,
yeah. Yeah, just by virtue of the circles that he moves in.
Mm-hmm. He gets away with a lot. I mean, and it even shows, you know, all these rich guys on a plane being like racist as hell against like Polish people, I think. He has a criticism of like the upper class, certainly.
It's specifically so that it's John Birch Society level conservatives. Yeah. Like it's specifically like that's, I think it's his father-in-law is in the John Birch Society.
Yeah. Yep. And he's in what, the Lions Club? Is that a thing?
So the Lions Club is real, but I don't really know if they have political leanings. I think it's mostly just like, all I remember is going to get frozen yogurt and they're being like free mints from the Lions Club. Like, I don't know if it's politically motivated mints or if they're just kind of vibing and they're retired. I don't really know.
Trent, not to dox you, but you live in the, and we're all in the belly of the beast, but you really live in the belly of the beast up there in DC. So I'm sure you see all kinds of great.
Yeah, works. No, I think Vonnegut would, I go absolutely bananas here just because I've told Jacob before, you go to a social gathering and someone will be like, oh, like, you know, what do you do? And they're like, oh, I work for the, you know, just the other day, someone was like, oh, I work over at Quantico and I look at, you know, F-35s and stuff all day. And, yeah, you know, I have a friend up here who looks at maps of other countries to bomb. And
I think you sent me like a fanny pack that you were like Koch brothers swag or something. Like
Yeah. No, it was at a party in DC and there was like, it was at the Anthem for people who live near here. And there was like a sign that said Koch brothers exclusive VIP party for like the it's just fun stuff like that, but as far as the book goes, I was really impressed. I think there's a lot of stuff in here that's evergreen, like we said, that the statistical information on the bombing has changed, but again, I think what you guys said about how Vonnegut was just like, well, really, it doesn't matter. Like,
plenty of people died in World War II. You know, right? Like, we don't have to.
But yeah, but so much is evergreen. I think I can't even imagine what it takes to go through what he went through and still with just subtle narrative devices be able to be like, this is what we went through. Like, I'm not going to get into the Eastern Front because that wasn't my experiences, but like he gives you just enough to be like, oh, that was like, that was hell's hell. Like they live, they were in hell. Like the Eastern Front was hell's hell, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think the historiography of like the war is every day, you know, of course supporting that and just like what the Eastern Front was like and what the Russian, you know, Soviet people had to give up to win that war. And just like the difference between how I'll always imagine this book, what I'll always think of is just gorgeous homoerotic British officers.
Oh my God.
And just listless, you know, Soviet soldiers, yeah, just looking out into the distance.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Yeah. The horror inherent in that, in the fact that, you know, there are sometimes wars that are necessary because the alternative to not fighting them is worse. And even when a necessary war is fought and prosecuted and eventually won, the scars that it leaves on you unmoor you from time if they don't kill you.
Absolutely. And it's not easy, you know. It's a very difficult thing. And Vonnegut himself, it later in life even reflected on World War II, feeling the necessity, but also said he felt like, he believed that the US had just taken up, you know, Nazi Germany's mantle. In a lot of ways, and he really felt that in a lot of ways that made a lot of their fighting feel, if not irrelevant, then at moments it felt less important. And he says in 2005, he says the world sees us as Nazi Germany and they're right. He's, you know, specifically talking about Bush's America. He says we're the same as them. He has a great passage that I wrote down from his book, which he's just writing down letters he's received and his responses. And I won't read the whole letter the guy wrote to him. This guy writes this whole letter saying, you're not a patriot. Saddam Hussein's going to come in over here any day, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. All this bullshit. And Vonnegut responds, please, for the sake of us all, get a shotgun, preferably a 12-gauge double barrel. And right there in your own neighborhood, blow off the heads of people, cops accepted, who may be armed. And that's his only response to him. And he says that's how he feels. And he goes on to say that's how he feels that that's how America wages war at this point. And how they want us to think is they want us to just, yeah, no, please save us all. Start killing everyone who has a gun. And then he just throws in cops accepted, you know, as an extra dig at the right wing of like, oh, well, not them. They're our heroes. You know, he maintained that to the end of his life. But I will, if y'all don't have any other thoughts, I had one more quote from Vonnegut. I kind of wanted to end things on, if that's okay.
Yeah, I want to share one last thing.
Yes, do it. I'm not in a rush.
Please. If anyone is into Tim and Eric or likes Tim Heidecker, he does have a song. I don't know if you guys know that he makes music, but he does have a song called Sirens of Titan about the fact that Tim Heidecker, when he was right wing, when he was younger, went to a college that Kurt Vonnegut was speaking at and like heckled him in the audience. And he's about how embarrassed he is as an adult.
Oh my God.
That like he went there because he was like anti-war and like yelled at Kurt Vonnegut.
Oh wow. So the song is like his like atonement for that.
Yeah. Just talking about how stupid that was to go to. So yeah, that's it. But I know you're about to say probably something serious, Jacob.
Man, I've got moments I look back and cringe on, but I'm glad I don't have anything like that.
If I heckled Kurt Vonnegut, that would be it, dog. I would
it would be all over, dog. Joss, any other thoughts before I close it on this? Because I think it's a good intonement to us all to make us to finish on a lighter note here.
Oh, please have at it.
Okay, I'll read this, and this is, you know, this isn't necessarily directly connected to the book. It is in some ways, but it is a great intonement, I think, for all of us. And it's this. And I'll just read this whole passage and close it on this. First rule, do not use semicolons. All they do is show you've been to college. And I realize some of you may be having trouble deciding whether I'm kidding or not. So from now on, I will tell you when I'm kidding. For instance, join the National Guard or the Marines and teach democracy. I'm kidding. We are about to be attacked by Al-Qaeda. Wave flags if you have them. That always seems to scare them away. I'm kidding. If you want to really hurt your parents and you don't have the nerve to be gay, the least you can do is go into the arts. I'm not kidding. The arts are not a way to make a living. They are a very human way of making life more bearable. Practicing an art, no matter how well or badly, is a way to make your soul grow. For heaven's sake, sing in the shower, dance to the radio, tell stories, write a poem to a friend, even a lousy poem. Do it as well as you possibly can. You will get an enormous reward. You will have created something, end quote. And you know, this is the show that we care about two things, you know, good fiction and changing the world. And Kurt Vonnegut, you know, he was a very depressed man at the end of his life, but damn it, he made some good fiction, and I appreciate him for that. So on that note, I'll just say, everybody, have a nice day, and so it goes.